Blood Witness, a novel by Dave Hitt. Available at bloodwitness.com. Episode 17, the final episode. Chapter 30. "This is it," Catherine said as Chris woke up. "Party time. Let's go get cleaned up first." They walked down the road until they came to their ratty hotel. Catherine led Chris to one of the doors, unlocked it, and said, "What a lovely place Sam booked for us. I get the first shower."
"So we pay a week's rent to take a shower once?"
"Once, twice, who knows? It's not like money's a problem, so stop being silly." Chris said, "You seem awfully chipper for someone who's about to face the world's most dangerous audience." Her smile vanished. "Would it make you feel any better to know I'm scared shitless? I have never, never done anything close to this. When this is over, if we survive, our lives will be changed forever."
"I'm getting used to that."
"Please don't be a smartass, Chris. I need you beside me. I can't imagine going through this alone. Not just the party, but whatever happens afterwards. The repercussions will be severe. We'll be pariahs amongst our own kind. I need to know that you'll stay with me."
"I'm not planning on going anywhere without you."
She kissed him, then headed for the bathroom. "I'll be out in a minute. After you take your shower, we'll grab a quick bite, then head for the field."
"Why don't I just join you in the shower?"
"Not tonight, dear. We're going to need all of our strength for this." After they both took showers, they crept through the streets looking for a quick meal. They found an old man dozing on his front porch. They listened closely for the sound of anyone else in the house, and when they were sure he was alone, they grabbed him, dragged him inside, and shared his blood. They left his naked body exposed to a south-facing window. They said nothing to each other as they walked slowly to the clearing. It was the size of a baseball field. The spring grasses were ankle-high. Small flowers added splotches of purple and yellow to the scene, colors no human would notice in the moonlight, and they filled the air with a delicate scent. The platform wasn't quite in the center of the field. Chris figured the Morrisseys put it there the previous morning, waiting for the sunrise to find the exact right spot. Catherine said, "Reach out." The two of them peered into the countryside for any sign of life, then touched the surrounding area, searching for any of their kind. Chris whispered, "Do you feel those two?" "Yes, they're about 4 miles away and heading in this direction. Hurry, before they get here." Chris stepped back, then stomped, and the trap door sprung open, revealing the 3 cases of elixir inside. He stepped into the hole and quickly passed them up to Catherine. He shut the trap while she unpacked the bottles, carefully arranging them so the marked ones were in the middle. They sat down, back to back, behind the deadly brew. A quick touch assured them that the two vampires they had just sensed had stopped in the woods and were watching them on the platform, waiting to see what happened. Nothing did for hours. They sat in silence, sensing more and more of their prey filling the woods around them. 2 hours before sunlight, Chris nudged Catherine. She nodded.
"Are you sure this will work?" he asked. His voice was low, but he knew their spies could hear him.
"Yes, I'm sure," Catherine answered. "I've seen it work before. The woman who taught me how to do this killed herself in despair over some foolish lover, but she had walked in the daylight for years. I had just been afraid to try it, unwilling to be invincible. I've always thought my limitations made me appreciate life a little more. The possibility of dying was slim, but knowing it was there added a little edge to my existence, a little thrill that I'll lose forever once we conquer the sunlight. I'll miss that edge, but there's a time for everything, and this is the time for us to take over. God knows the mortals have screwed up everything. Maybe this is how it was always meant to be."
There are more of them in the trees now, eavesdropping on their quiet conversation. They continued to talk about how wonderful it would be when they could all walk in the daylight, with mortals trembling at the sight of them.
Carl stepped out of the woods and onto the field. William joined them. A few minutes later, another vampire stepped into the clearing, waiting at the edge as if she were afraid to come any closer. One by one, more of them stepped out,
all waiting, as if for an invitation. Catherine stood up and announced in a clear, confident voice, "In 1 hour the sun will rise. 1 hour from now we'll all watch it rise together. Then we will walk among the mortals and at last claim our rightful place in the world. Step forward, my friends. The voyage begins now." They approached the stage slowly, nervously watching each other. "Friends," Catherine said, "we have no need to fear each other. We are about to embark on a journey of eternal conquest. When this night is over, mortal men and vampire alike will tremble before us. We will be invincible." Chris recognized the members of the gang that attacked him. One of them shouted, "Why should we believe you? You show up out of nowhere, pick fights with us, and all of a sudden you want to be friends. Something ain't right." "You're right," Catherine said. "Something ain't right. We have a crazy man on the loose, threatening all of us with his stupidity. He has already done the damage and revealed our existence to the world. If we do nothing, humans will hunt us down and destroy us. The few who survive will have to hide for the next few centuries, living like dogs waiting for the world to forget. Or we can turn this to our advantage and take our rightful place among these inferior beings." Chris, standing beside her on the stage, counted the audience. There were 56 of them, including William and Carl. Someone near the front yelled, "Who the hell are you, lady?" She seemed to grow taller in response to the question. "I," she said boldly, "am Catherine Nightshade. I have walked through the streets of the Roman Empire. I have been counsel to kings and popes. I had feasted on thousands before your great-great-great-great-grandfather was born. I have tasted the blood of saints and the blood of warriors. I am Catherine of Rome." She looked down at the man who asked the question and said in a perfect Brooklyn accent, "Now, who the fuck are you?" Most of the crowd laughed nervously. He shrank back and in a small voice said, "Nobody." "That," she said, her voice once again regal, "is an inappropriate response. You are a creature of the night, and soon, very soon, my friend, you will be a creature of the day, a creature of eternity." Someone from the back asked, "Why are you willing to share this with us? Why not just do it yourself?" There was a general murmur of agreement in the crowd. "I don't want to live in fear to wonder what horrible fate will befall me if someone uncovers my secret. If there are many of us, we won't have to hide what we are. No one will dare attack any one of us. It would be suicide." "So," someone interrupted, "are we it? Are we the only ones that are going to benefit from your secret sauce?" "I haven't decided that yet. We'll see how this works out, and if need be, I'll share the secret with others." "So you get to decide. Who made you boss?" She bent over and picked up a bottle. She held it over her head. "This," she said, "gives me the right to decide. No one else knows how to make it or how to use it. I'll show you what to do at the appropriate moment. The recipe, however, shall remain my secret. Anyone who is dissatisfied with this arrangement is free to leave now. This morning, after the sunrise, the first thing us daytime vampires will do is decide what to do about the nighttime vampires. When we do, we'll hunt you down and let you know." Someone said something under their breath, and Catherine asked, "What was that?"
"Nothing."
"No, I want to hear what everyone has to say. What was it?"
"It was one of the older ones."
"I said, how do we know we can trust you? You could just be setting us up. Look at me. I'm standing here in front of you with my mate. There is no cover nearby." She pointed to the east. "Soon the sun will rise over that mountain. When it does, it'll strike all of us. Whatever happens to you will happen to me as well. I didn't get to be 2,000 years old by taking foolish risks. This will make us truly immortal. I am confident enough to stake my life and the life of my lover on that. Tell me, what else would you have me do? And I'll do it. I'll have you drink it first and then come back tomorrow night and give it to the rest of us."
"Coward!" she shouted. "Why should I share eternity with one who doesn't trust me? Go, if you will. Go back to your sleeping hole or your coffin or wherever you go to hide from the daylight. While you cower in the darkness, the rest of us will drink a toast to your foolishness under the noonday sun."
He stood silently for a moment, and then said in an even voice, "I am not as ancient as you, Catherine of Rome, but I will soon mark my years in millennia instead of centuries. Through those many years, I've learned to trust my instincts. I must listen to them now and decline your offer. I only ask that you respect my decision." He turned and walked toward the forest. Catherine looked into the crowd and asked, "Anyone else care to leave? Now is the time." One other vampire, a female, walked quickly towards the woods. There was a little murmuring, but no one else left.
"Well, now that that's settled, let's get started. You must follow my instructions exactly. First, everyone gets one of these." She held up the bottle. She and Chris stepped down from the stage and passed the bottles out. When Carl and William came forward, Chris gave each of them one of the bottles with a tiny scratch on it. He was tempted to wink at them, but in a group as observant as this one, such a simple gesture could be their undoing. When everyone had received a bottle, Chris and Catherine got back on the stage. Catherine waited for the talking to die down. "We have about a half an hour before sunrise. Don't open your bottles until I tell you to. The timing of this is crucial. Do exactly what I do, when I do, and you will join me in immortality. Deviate from it, and I have no idea what the results will be, but it's not too likely you'll enjoy them. I suggest you use this time to contemplate what you want to do this morning. How will you spend your first day in the sunlight?"
They milled around, talking quietly. Their eyes darted from side to side, always checking their surroundings. William felt someone clutch his shoulder lightly. It was Eric, who was ancient enough to look like a 30-year-old man. "William, my friend, our paths cross too seldom. What do you think of all this?" William shook his old friend's hand. "Eric, you're right. We don't get together often enough. Carl and I know this woman pretty well, and I think she's on the level."
"Yes," Carl added. "We never seem to get together."
When Eric turned toward him, Carl silently mouthed the word, "Leave."
"We should make some plans for a party."
Eric asked, "Now?"
"Now or soon," Carl said.
Eric smiled and said, "Thanks." He turned and walked into the forest. The punks who had attacked Chris pushed to the front of the audience. There were seven of them, dressed in leather jackets that almost matched. The leader pointed a finger at Chris and said, "I think you're trying to scam us. We almost killed you. Why would you do us any favors?"
Chris relaxed for a moment, then felt the fire fill him.
"What makes you think I'm doing you a favor? If you go along with this, you're going to be taking orders from me. We'll have jobs for sloppy punks, things we need done without dirtying our own hands, and you'll suffice. And what if we don't like that arrangement?"
Chris concentrated on the leader. "Then," Chris said, "I'll do what I want with you. After tonight, you'll be stronger and faster, but I suspect you'll be just as stupid. Your new abilities may make you a bit more of a challenge, but not enough to make any difference. Hell, 10 of you couldn't catch one of me before, even after you slit my throat. Of course, you can leave now. We won't stop you. Then, when this is over, I'll decide what to do to you. I just might kill you in the daylight, when I can move and you can't. Or maybe I'll just put a price on your head and bet how long you can outsmart the humans. Whatever I decide, you'll have nothing to say about it."
Chris continued, "Decide fast, dickheads, because I'm getting sick of looking at you. If you're going to stay, then stay and shut up. I don't want to hear anything from any of you until after sunrise. If you're going to leave, do it now. And if I see you talking to anyone but each other, we may decide to open the proceedings with a sacrifice."
5 minutes before sunrise, Catherine took to the stage again. Chris joined her.
"Listen carefully," she said. "At the moment I tell you to, you must open your bottle and drink the entire thing. Let me warn you, it will taste vile. Then, turn to face the sun. When you feel it on your skin, your natural instinct will be to run, or to dig. Resist it. Let the sunlight sink into your skin. It may feel like it's burning at first, but as it soaks in, your body will become immune to it. What begins as a fire will end as a gentle warmth.
and then you will be truly immortal.
Hey, one of the punks said, I ain't got no bottle opener.
Some of his friends laughed, but Catherine glared in their direction and said, Silence, fools, or I'll take the elixir from you right now.
We should partake in just a couple of minutes.
Ah, my friends, this shall be glorious.
Are you ready?
Open your bottles.
A voice from the edge of the clearing shouted, No! Stop! It's a trick! She's trying to kill all of you!
Stephen burst from the forest and ran to the stage.
It's a trick! She gave me some of this garbage, only she didn't tell me it would make me immortal, just extra strong and quick. I drank it, and then all of a sudden I couldn't move. She had me drink it just before the sunrise, too, to try and kill me, but I escaped.
Chris was looking at Catherine with his mouth open.
That's why, he started, but Catherine cut him off with a shrill shout. This man, she screamed, is the man who has made all of this necessary. He's the one who has revealed our existence to the world, all because he cannot accept being a blood drinker.
Listen to me, all of you, Stephen shouted. Drop those bottles, smash them, you'll die if you don't.
Sunrise was 2 minutes away.
Decide! Catherine's voice was shrill. Decide whether to believe this unworthy idiot who writes messages in blood or someone who has walked the earth for nearly 2 millennia. She held up her bottle and flicked off the cap with her thumb. Decide and choose well if you wish to spend eternity hiding from the sunlight or walking in it fearlessly.
There were shouts of confusion in the crowd. 3 vampires dropped their bottles and ran for the woods. Another dropped to his knees and began digging himself under the ground.
I shall drink first, Catherine said, and tilted the bottle toward her lips.
Stephen jumped on the stage, lunged toward Catherine, and grabbed the bottle from her hand. He turned to the audience and said to her, Why not switch bottles with someone else? He leapt from the stage, landing inches away from another vampire, grabbed the already open bottle from his hand, shoving Catherine's bottle in its place. He hopped back to the stage and shouted, Drink this one, bitch! She grabbed it from him and said, Very well.
Chris started a protest, but a loud no filled his mind. Catherine sent the thought at him with such force he winced. She picked Stephen up by the collar and said, And you bastard, will die watching. She turned toward the audience and drank the poison in a few quick gulps.
Chris said, He's my dad. Please, let him go.
Catherine said, Drink, Chris, please, drink.
She dropped Stephen to the stage. Not because of Chris's request, but because she no longer had the strength to hold him aloft.
Everyone was watching her, and her weakness was starting to show.
Chris raised his bottle and said in a loud voice, It's showtime, folks! He drained his marked bottle, and after a brief moment of hesitation, everyone left in the crowd joined him.
Chris grabbed his father's collar and yanked him to his feet. He pulled him close and whispered, Dig a hole, fast, and you may make it, then flung him behind the platform.
A thin sliver of sunlight gleamed on the edge of the mountaintop. Stephen, hidden from the rest of them by the stage, began digging furiously with his hands.
Chris felt himself weakening from the rising sun.
He said, Raise your hands, my friends. Immortality is ours.
They did, and a shaft of sunlight hit them.
Sam had positioned the stage perfectly.
The direct sunlight hit those in front of the audience, but was, for the moment, just over his and Catherine's heads. The light hit his outstretched hands, and they felt like they were being seared with a branding iron. He dropped his arms and turned to Catherine, just in time to see her collapse. He stepped back and stomped, and nothing happened. He stomped again, and there was still no response. On the third try, the trap door slid open beneath her. She half fell into the hole, but didn't have the strength to drag herself all the way in. Chris fell on top of her and shoved her weak limbs through the hole about the same time he heard the screaming. They hadn't considered the screaming. The agony of 50 souls crying out in rage and pain filled the field and the forest, bouncing off the mountainside and echoing through the still morning air. Chris shoved Catherine's limp body aside to make room for himself, trying not to look at the melting faces of the dying. They were dragging themselves through the grass, toward the stage, intent on revenge. He glanced behind the stage and caught a glimpse of his father, still in the shade, almost hidden in the hole he was frantically digging.
Chris squeezed inside the box as one of the vampires fell on the platform. The creature reached into the hole and grabbed Chris's throat with a shriveled, bloody hand. Chris pressed the button and the trapdoor slid shut, severing the hand. There was a deadbolt inside with a lock attached, but he didn't have the strength to reach up and fasten it. Just before he passed out, he heard the sound of wood shattering and felt the dull thump of boiling stumps pounding on the steel walls of their prison. The short-lived screams woke up dozens of people who thought it must have been a bad dream and drifted back to sleep. Victor Madison was already awake, though, and he knew what he heard was real. He had just finished putting on yesterday's jeans and shirt when the screaming started. It stopped just as he ran out of his house. He started his motorcycle and headed in the direction of the noise. Unsure what he was looking for, he cruised slowly, looking to the right and the left, scanning the fields and the wooded areas as he passed them. He rode for a little more than a mile before he saw it. There was a small clearing in front of a forested area, and several fresh tire marks in the grass led into the trees. He rode to the edge of the forest, turned his bike off, and walked into the woods. He knew the clearing was there, and it only took him a few minutes to reach it. There were four men on the far side of the field, and as he watched, they struggled to get a large box of some kind into the back of a truck. He could just barely hear their cursing and grunting in the otherwise quiet morning air. If he wanted to, he could reach them before they finished loading whatever it was, but there were four of them, and one of him, and they didn't seem to want company. He watched them finish loading the truck, then drive away. He ran toward where the truck had been, but stopped when he noticed the clothes on the ground. They were all sizes and styles and arranged as if someone had been laying down in them. He picked up a jacket, and dust as fine as talcum powder drifted out of one of the sleeves. There were small brown bottles scattered among the clothes. He picked one up and sniffed the opening, then made a face and said, "Shit, that's horrible." Epilogue. 3 months later. Chris was lying on the bed, staring up at nothing in particular. He wasn't hungry or tired or even bored. He was comfortable and content, curling and uncurling his toes for lack of anything better to do. William and Carl had told him he could use their New Jersey camp for as long as he needed to, but he'd been saving the cash and jewelry from his victims and soon would have enough for a down payment on his own place. Catherine gave him the Morrissey's phone number before she left, so he would just pick out a place and let them worry about the details. A few days after the party, the police had found a dead recluse in a hotel room, surrounded by old vampire comic books and religious paraphernalia. His dresser drawers held personal possessions of some of the victims. An autopsy revealed he had died of a heart attack. Chris suspected it was the work of William and Carl, but saw no reason to ask them about it. He wanted to believe his father was out there somewhere. Maybe he had gone elsewhere to sort things out, or was just staying out of sight while he came to terms with what he was. The vampire killings had stopped after the party, and no one, mortal or vampire, had seen him since. Not that the local vampires went out of their way to speak to Chris. He was persona non grata amongst the few who had not fallen victim to the party. Much of their reaction was hatred, but some of it was fear, too. As the offspring of an ancient, he was not one to be trifled with. But he was used to being an outcast and shrugged it off. Besides, there weren't enough vampires left in the city for it to be a problem. No matter how Catherine explained it, he couldn't accept what she had done to his father. If she had discussed it with him first, or at least told him about it right after it happened, he might have been able to forgive her. Instead, he learned of her treachery in front of dozens of dangerous killers. She had lied to him, after promising him it was the one thing she would never do. After the party, as the days passed, he found her touch less and less stimulating, until it just aggravated him. She left once he convinced her she could never regain his affection. He wasn't sure where she had gone. She had mentioned Chicago, but could be anywhere. A week after she left, he stopped by their old house. It was almost empty, with just a few scattered pieces of furniture left behind.
There was a for sale sign at the end of the driveway.
He had considered finding a woman, or maybe just a girl, to join him, but decided against it, at least for now. The city was full of lovely mortal females, and he wanted to enjoy being a bachelor for a while. He didn't need a mate just yet, but a roommate might be fun. He picked up the phone and dialed Curly's number.
That's it, folks. How'd you like it? Drop me a line. Send me a note. Hitman@davehit.com. Or you can leave a comment on the blog at bloodwitness.com. Or do both. And when you're done there, stop by davehit.com, spelled with two T's. Check out the Quick Hits podcast, which has been pretty much on hiatus because of this project, so I'll be getting back into that. The Quick Hits blog, the Hitman Chronicle, and a plethora of other stuff. All at davehit.com. Thanks very much to Pete Palladino of the Badleys for letting me use his song, What a Difference a Year Makes, for the intro and the outro music. You can find more of his stuff at badleys.com. Thanks to Johnny Virgil for help with the graphics on the Blood Witness site. His blog, 15 Minute Lunch, is the funniest thing on the internet. Check it out. Thanks to Evo Terra for releasing Blood Witness on patiobooks.com. You can find hundreds of other great patio books there. Thanks to Hitman's Henchmen for their help in promoting the book. And finally, thanks to all of you for listening. Fraction tales from fax machines. I custom made detachment gray. Yeah, there's something in the way. You learn to swerve but never leave. And oh, what a difference a year makes. Oh, what a difference a year makes. Oh, oh, what a difference a year makes. Oh, what a difference a year makes. Oh, no. Breeze deposits on their specs from the kids who wrote the checks that let the sad parade begin. Oh no.